After today, the impeachment of President Trump will be history. We look back at the five-month roller coaster and how we got here.
We did not want to work with Mr. Giuliani. Simply put, we were playing the hand we were dealt.
Also today, Westerners head to Peru for traditional healing.
You actually viscerally in your body, you feel the power of the Icarus. So it may bring on sort of shaking or many, many things.
But Peruvians say their culture is being stolen. And new revelations about Beethoven and his hearing. He was not deaf in his final years.
Beethoven, I think, is one of those very lucky few people who actually take delight at hearing a baby screech at the dinner table.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here today. Hong Kong will soon impose a mandatory 2-week quarantine on all visitors from mainland China. It's an effort to stem the spread of the coronavirus. The semi-autonomous city has had about 24 confirmed cases and one fatality. A cruise ship with 3,600 passengers is docked in Hong Kong's Victoria Harbor. The passengers and crew can't leave until they're screened for the coronavirus after 3 Chinese passengers tested positive for the virus. Earlier today, I spoke with the BBC's Danny Vincent, who is in Hong Kong, and I asked him what we know about the man who died.
This virus, the outbreak took place during Chinese New Year. Hong Kong is part of China, but it has a separate system, which means that many Chinese mainlanders would have gone back to the mainland during Chinese New Year and would have returned to Hong Kong. And the person that sadly deceased from the coronavirus was an example of that. He was a young man. He travelled to the mainland. He travelled to Wuhan and he returned to Hong Kong. Shortly after, he went to hospital. He had the symptoms and very sadly, he passed away.
So as of today, what steps has Hong Kong taken to try to keep the coronavirus from spreading?
Well, many Hong Kong medical professionals have actually gone on strike. They're fighting and protesting because they want the leader here, Carrie Lam, to try to close all of the borders that connect Hong Kong to the rest of China. Carrie Lam has refused to do this. She says it's against the World Health Organization's protocol, but she has closed 3 of the borders that connect Hong Kong to the mainland. The other initiative that the authorities here have introduced is that they've asked anybody that comes back to Hong Kong from the mainland to spend 14 days under essentially self-quarantine. And they've advised that people should wear masks if they go outside and that the usual precautions when it comes to self-hygiene are being applied here.
Carrie Lam is hearing from medical professionals, but she's ignoring them essentially?
That's right. I mean, she's made some concessions because after the first day of the strike, she announced that she would close 3 of the borders. But the thing is, when it comes to issues like this in Hong Kong, there's always a political dimension. Last year, Hong Kong saw 6 months of relentless protests, and many people here are quite concerned about the future of this semi-autonomous city. Of course, it has many differences from the mainland of China. So there's the argument that some of the perhaps medical professionals are also maybe at least a little bit politically minded. It's very symbolic. If all the borders were to close, it would maybe be seen as somewhat of a victory for the pro-democracy camp here in Hong Kong.
That's an interesting dynamic. So I'm curious, have you been, Danny, to any of the border checkpoints and just describe what they look like and what the scene is at these points of entry and exit?
Unfortunately, I haven't, because I've been in the mainland recently, and upon returning, I'm actually now under self-imposed quarantine myself, like many of the people here in Hong Kong. And there's an argument that perhaps these borders that have closed haven't necessarily limited the number of people returning from the mainland. Of course, the majority of people that come from the mainland actually fly. Today, actually, Hong Kong's flagship airline, Cathay Pacific, they announced that they've seen a fall of around 90% of their flights to mainland China. And as a result of that, they've asked around 27,000 members of their staff to take voluntary annual unpaid leave, essentially, for around 3 weeks.
What is your daily routine like? Are you staying inside?
I'm staying inside every day. I'm under self-quarantine. Occasionally, I do go out to stock up on food and essentials that I might need. But much of my life, like many of the people I've spoken to, it exists now on social media. I'm trying to speak to people that are in Wuhan, in Beijing and Shanghai, across mainland China, and of course people here in Hong Kong, to try to get a sense of what they make of this outbreak and how they see this emergency, what type of impact they think that's going to have, not only on the short term, but their long-term futures here as well.
So when you nip out to get a pack of ramen or something, I mean, what's it like on the streets? Is it really crowded? Because usually it's a pretty busy city, Hong Kong.
It's usually a very, very busy city. Nowadays, the streets are fairly empty. Some of the supermarkets, however, are quite busy. There's usually quite a lot of people trying to buy essentials. Most people are wearing masks. Some people are wearing goggles. But there is certainly, you can feel it in this city, that people are anxious because they simply don't really know what's going to happen next.
The BBC's Danny Vincent, self-quarantined in Hong Kong. Thank you very much, Danny. Stay safe.
Thank you.
The Chinese city of Wuhan is where the coronavirus was first detected. The city and the entire province that surrounds it, Hubei, is in lockdown. Canadian Stephen Lee teaches in Wuhan, and he was stuck in his apartment for 11 days. He was getting pretty antsy and needed some groceries, so he got on his bike and cycled to a supermarket.
I mean, it feels good to be outside. Like, the air is a lot fresher, it seems. Not a lot of people. It's kind of scary, though, but, you know, it feels good to be outside after being trapped in so long inside. All right, normally this area that I'm going to right now, it's usually a little more populated, but we'll see. I mean, there's a couple people here. It's not like there's nobody. I doubt the supermarket. I don't think it's open. Yeah, it's closed. I mean, I guess I'm not getting anything today.
Canadian Stephen Lee cycling around a very quiet Wuhan. From one stressful situation to another, residents of southwest Puerto Rico say the earth started moving beneath their feet in late December. In some ways, it has not stopped shaking since. That's because Puerto Ricans have experienced 11 significant earthquakes in the past 40 days and thousands of smaller ones. The most recent big one, a 5.3 magnitude that struck yesterday. Residents in the city of Ponce are not far from the quake's offshore epicenter. Luis Echevarria is a businessman there. He says yesterday's quake was especially jarring.
It was very early in the morning, and I was getting ready for work, and all of a sudden, everything started shaking. The windows started shaking, the closet door started shaking, the bed, everything was shaking for like 20, 30 seconds.
What has it been like living through this for so long?
It's crazy because it's like they're moving the floor every time you try to take a step. And since December, the earth's been shaking. It's weird that it's always been shaking in the southern part of the island, and specifically to the south-south-west part of the island. The stronger quakes have been there, and there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of confusion, a lot of people that need psychological help. Some of the houses, people, they're scared to go in. They're scared if they go in, a quake will happen and the roof will fall on top of me. And that happened, actually. Some of the houses fell on top of cars and fell sideways. Balconies are no longer there. It's weird. That's the word. It's weird. It's crazy.
So I know your town, Ponce, has been hit by quakes, but nearby other towns have been hit even harder. You traveled to some of those places. Are you kind of like describing what you saw there?
Yeah. There were some roads that were closed. In the Guanica and Diaoco area, people suffer more because the epicenter was right there and they're close to them. A friend of mine that lived near the coast said that, well, I lost my house, but not my reason. And it was a really nice house, and it's gone. I mean, it's lost.
So with those homes collapsing, people are scared to move back inside. Where are they sleeping? Where are they living?
They're living in their cars. They're living in tents outside of their houses, close to their cars, close to their belongings. It's a struggle because there's this house that's not safe anymore, but my memories are there, my belongings are there. I need to leave, but I don't want to leave, so what do I do? So I just park my car in front, and I sleep in the car. And if I'm lucky to get a tent, I put the tent near to my car, and I live there. And neighbors will help, some help will come. Because at this time, this is where people get closer. When everything's hard for others, we tend to help and lend a hand. But it's hard, even for the kids. I've met a couple that had two kids, and their children don't dare going inside the house. So, again, there's a struggle because there's the fear, and it's hard to say. You can see we've been trying to recover from Maria. Hurricanes, you know where they're coming. You know where they're going. You know where they're gone. Earthquakes, not so much.
And those kids, I mean, have school buildings collapsed and are schools still in session?
School in some areas are not in session. Some of the schools are not certified safe. And there's some, you say, we say, they say, in terms of how safe it is. But most of the kids are not going to school. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle.
Well, there was this kind of odd sidebar a few weeks ago. A warehouse that was full of aid supplies was found in Ponce, and those supplies apparently came from disaster relief after Hurricane Maria in 2017. People were pretty outraged over that, right?
Oh, yeah. They were outraged because, again, at that time and nowadays, there's still people in need. Who takes care of them?
Who's to blame for all that aid in that warehouse that should have been used and gone to people like 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
That I totally agree with you. I don't know. But the processes that were supposed to be in place apparently were not in place. And when you do that and you overlook what needs to be done, these things happen.
Luis Echevarria is a businessman who lives in Ponce, Puerto Rico, close to the epicenter of the recent string of earthquakes. Luis, thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you so much, sir.
Last week on the show, we told you how cows talk to each other. This week, penguins take the stage. The world's Bianca Hillier explains.
Penguins might not be able to fly. They waddle, they splash. They're kind of adorable. Then there's the squawking. Now, a new study from the University of Torino is taking a closer look at those squawks. Turns out, they're called songs. Stuart Semple at the University of Roehampton in London studies the way animals communicate with each other.
Their songs have a structure that is strikingly similar to what we see in human language.
The new penguin study was conducted in Italian zoos. It looked at 600 songs from 28 adult African penguins. Songs like this. Doesn't sound human-like to me, but the researchers found there is a parallel here. They concluded that the penguin songs share the same structure as human language. Marco Gamba is a co-author of the new study.
Penguins are not using words, of course.
No words, but they're still conveying a message. Gamba and his team found that penguins make different sounds. Some are short, some are longer, just like humans. But penguins usually keep things simple.
And it's interesting to see that these short units are more common than the others because that's exactly what happens in the human language.
To be clear, we're talking about the structure of penguin songs being similar to human language, not the actual meaning.
It's always an art task to decode the meaning of animal calls.
Fully understanding the language of penguins will require more research. Scientists can't fully decode penguin songs quite yet, but they know what this song means.
To convince females about the fact that I'm the right male and you can have me as a partner.
Turns out mating season is when penguins are the most vocal. Professor Semple said the takeaway here is that a simple rule could underpin the way all animals communicate.
It says actually something quite interesting about language. Language might not be as distinct and as unique as we might think it would be.
Maybe Dr. Doolittle was onto something.
I love to talk to the animals. It's incredible.
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
To sit and natter with a tiger, chatter with a cheetah, that's a neat achievement, you'll agree. If I could talk to the animals, learn their languages, I would be the greatest man on earth.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Prosecutors in France are investigating a prominent figure skating coach after allegations that he raped a French skater when she was a teenager. Sarah Abitbol, who won a world championship bronze medal, says the abuse first began when she was 15. French authorities say they will try to determine if any other athletes were abused as well. Anita Elash has our report from Paris.
Sarah Abitbol made the allegations in her new autobiography published last week. She said her figure skating coach, Gilles Baer, raped her repeatedly back in the early 1990s when she was between the ages of 15 and 17. Speaking to a French news channel, Abitbol said that nearly 30 years later, she's still on antidepressants.
Je ne pouvais plus supporter l'idée que cet entraîneur soit toujours en place.
She said she decided to tell her story because she could no longer stand the idea that Bayer was still training children. She said she felt guilty about her silence and couldn't stand it anymore. Bayer, the skating coach, admitted he had what he described as intimate and inappropriate relations with Abid Bol. He told the French news agency AFP that he's sincerely sorry. The allegations have shocked the sports world and the public in France. The head of the French Ice Skating Federation, Didier Gayaguet, has also expressed shock. But there are allegations that he may have covered up for Bayer, and the national sports minister, Roxana Maracineanu, says he should take responsibility for the scandal and resign.
Le président de la Fédération française des sports de glace, Didier Gayaguet.
The president of the French Skating Federation cannot clear himself from his moral and personal responsibilities. Beyond its president, the nature and number of facts causes me to think that this grave dysfunction is at the least the result of an institutionalized breach. Silence seems to have been the rule for a number of elected leaders.
So far, Gayaguet has refused to step down as president of the Skating Federation. At a press conference today, he said he was disgusted to learn about the allegations from Abid Bol.
I am dismayed by the sad fact that these women's lives have been shattered, forever shaken by the weakness of disreputable men who took advantage of their innocence. There are no words to describe my disgust.
Gayaguet went on to defend his decision not to step down.
J'ai aussi été un patineur. J'étais un entraîneur.
I was also a skater, a trainer. I managed some of these people, but you will never find my name in cases of violence or child abuse or the abuse of adolescents. I am an imperfect man, but I am clean.
Two other skating coaches in France face similar accusations of sexual assault. One of them has denied the allegations. The other has refused to comment publicly. Prosecutors say the truth will come out in the coming weeks as they try to establish if any other athletes were abused. For The World, Anita Ilash, Paris.
Legend goes that at the premiere of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the audience burst into applause, but Beethoven had no idea what was going on because he was deaf. Now a musicologist in Ohio says this story is not accurate. I asked Ted Albrecht how he concluded that Beethoven still had some hearing in his later years.
Since 2007, I've been translating what are called Beethoven's conversation books. These are the blank booklets that he started to use in 1818 when he was about 47 years old for his friends to write down their parts of conversations, and then he could reply out loud, orally. And so we have a collection of about 139 surviving conversation books. Every page you turn, there's some new discovery, some new insight. And I got up to the point in 1823 when Beethoven tells someone, by not using ear trumpets too much, I have preserved the hearing in my left ear.
How did the story of Beethoven's deafness even originate, and why do you think it's persisted?
His secretary, Anton Schindler, wrote it in the biography. The alto singer, who was at the Ninth Symphony, said that she had turned him around. But one story says it was at the end of the symphony. One says that it's at the end of the second movement, the scherzo. But there are a couple of entries that say that the applause took place during the scherzo, where the timpani interrupt the flow of the music. You get the audience went absolutely crazy and started to applaud. Beethoven was sitting in the orchestra trying to listen as best he could with his faint hearing, and so Carolina Unger, the alto soloist, turned him around to show him, and he acknowledged the applause.
Mm. So, Ted, your conclusion, Beethoven was hard of hearing near the end of his life, was also concerned with hearing loss, but he was not deaf. I mean, a lot of people find it inspirational, even miraculous, that one of the world's greatest composers was able to do his works without being able to hear them. Do you think your discovery might disappoint a lot of people just for busting open that myth?
Oh, who knows? It might. That's all right. We don't mind that at all. One of the great things that came out of this is that in the last years of his life, Beethoven lived across the street from an old friend of his, and he had a 13-year-old son who came to visit Beethoven in his last days. This was very nice. Mm. And occasionally they would have Beethoven over for dinner. The youngster himself grew up, and he wrote his reminiscences about Beethoven. And he said, Beethoven was stone deaf in his last years. I can attest to this. He said, but one time when Beethoven was over at our house for dinner, my baby sister screeched at the table, and Beethoven laughed at being able to hear it. So Beethoven, I think, is one of those very lucky few people who actually take delight at hearing a baby screech at the dinner table.
Ted Albrecht, a musicologist at Kent State University. Thanks very much for talking to us.
You are more than welcome.
You're listening to The World. Venezuela's opposition leader had a moment in the spotlight at the State of the Union address.
Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President.
But are people in Venezuela cheering? I'm Marco Werman, Venezuela's political stalemate. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. Last night's State of the Union address had a surprise special guest.
Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President, please take this.
After 30 seconds of one of the night's few moments of bipartisan applause, Trump spoke to the Venezuelan opposition leader in the mezzanine, Juan Guaido.
Please take this message back that all Americans are united with the Venezuelan people in their righteous struggle for freedom. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Today, Trump meets with Guaido at the White House. The World's Jorge Valencia is with me. So what's the significance of Trump inviting Guaido to the White House, Jorge?
Juan Guaido, the opposition leader in Venezuela, in an effort to gain legitimacy over the past year since he was elected, has taken a two-prong approach. The first one is to gain support from the populace, and the second one is to use international pressure to presumably push President Nicolas Maduro out of office. He was in Western Europe last week. He met with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. But by far, his most important ally is the United States. So there was a lot of question about whether or not he was going to see President Trump. So everybody was really surprised to see him show up at the State of the Union yesterday and to be invited to the White House today. So this is actually something that is quite a big deal for him.
Yeah, it stunned a lot of people. How has the Trump administration provided support to Guaido and to the Venezuelan opposition?
Well, the symbolism of acknowledging Juan Guaido as, in President Trump's words, the legitimate president of Venezuela, that has a lot of weight. Like I said, there are dozens of countries that are providing that support. Also, Venezuela is a country that is in a humanitarian crisis. There are, according to the United Nations, 4 million people in dire needs in the country. 5 million people have left the country in the past 10 years. And the United States has provided, through USAID, lots of humanitarian support in the country. One thing that the United States has not done is provided temporary protected status for Venezuelan immigrants in the United States. This is something that some humanitarians have called for, but it would not be very congruent with the Trump administration's migration policies. They have really curtailed any possibilities of people seeking refuge in the United States. But that is one thing that the United States has not done that some people have called for.
But just recognizing Juan Guaido as the legitimate president is huge coming from Washington.
It is a very big deal.
So while Guaido is meeting with Trump, Nicolas Maduro is going to get a visit from Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. What is Russia's role in all this?
While Juan Guaido has the support of the United States and other countries, Nicolas Maduro, President Nicolas Maduro, has the support of Cuba, China, and his biggest supporter, his most important supporter, is Vladimir Putin. Jason Marzak is with the Atlantic Council, which is a think tank in Washington.
Russia sees Venezuela as this incredible opportunity to cause havoc and chaos in the Americas, which has direct national security implications for the United States. And they're able to do it without spending a lot of money, but causing maximum uncertainty.
So if Foreign Minister Lavrov is meeting with Nicolas Maduro on Friday, if that is a coincidence, then it is a heck of a coincidence.
Maduro and others have said that Juan Guaido is conspiring with the United States to overthrow Venezuela's legitimate government. Can being seen with Trump backfire on Juan Guaido?
Well, I was on the phone with a man from in Maracaibo, one of the larger cities in Venezuela this week, and he said that he didn't quite appreciate that Juan Guaido is on tour, meeting with foreign dignitaries, and more or less airing the country's dirty laundry in public. And the United States is a country that, as you know, is not very popular in many parts of the world, and certainly not in Venezuela. Michael Shifter from the Inter-American Dialogue, which is a think tank, says that Maduro is a master at exploiting that.
Guaido is in an impossible position. He can't do without the United States because of its power. He needs that alliance. But on the other hand, being close to the Trump administration comes with some baggage, especially in Latin America.
So, Jorge, what is the takeaway here? How is this strategy actually working out for Juan Guaido?
It's not going great so far. Guaido, when he declared himself the president a year ago, he was seen as somebody who would potentially unite the opposition in Venezuela. But the opposition in Venezuela, as is the case in so many places, is multiple groups, and not all of them right now support Guaido. So one could presume that perhaps when he returns to Venezuela, he might recalibrate what his strategy is. And that is depending on what happens when he returns to Venezuela, because he had to escape the country, he had to basically sneak out of his own country because he had been prohibited by the Maduro administration from leaving. So I think a lot of us are going to be observing to see what happens when he returns to Venezuela.
The World's Jorge Valencia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Butterflies in Mexico and murder. It's a grim contrast. Two people connected to one of Mexico's largest butterfly reserves were found dead less than a week apart. Last year, 12 environmental defenders were killed in Mexico. Amnesty International Americas is alarmed. From Mexico City, director Erica Guevara Rosas joined us to talk about one of the men. Homero Gomez Gonzalez was one of the best-known defenders of monarch butterflies.
Homero Gomez was very well known for his protection of the monarch butterfly in Michoacán. He administered sanctuaries to protect the monarch butterfly, but he was also a protector of the environment. He denounced many times illegal logging in the area, the increased presence of groups of the organized crime that were trying to take over certain territories and land and threatened the environment where these monarch butterflies arrive every year in Mexico.
We get a nice sense of his commitment to what he was doing with a video he posted just last month on Twitter. So he's in his butterfly sanctuary and thousands of butterflies are swirling all around him. He's pretty happy and proudly declares in his tweet that the sanctuary in Michoacán is the biggest in the world. It's kind of a sad video in retrospect, shot a couple of weeks before Gomez Gonzalez was killed. It does occur to me, though, he was a butterfly conservationist. Who was he threatening?
I mean, he was threatening many groups. He was denouncing not just the illegal logging of criminal groups, but also the collusion of some local authorities with these groups. We have to put things in context. Michoacán is one of the most violent states in Mexico. This is an state where there are many people who have been missing over the last years precisely because of the increased influence of the organized crime in the state.
Your own organization, Amnesty International, has said Mexico is one of the most dangerous countries in the world to be an environmental activist. Why is that?
Last year, in 2019, we documented that at least 12 environmental defenders were killed in different parts of the country, and the impunity remains as the norm. There is a lack of justice. The main line of investigation should be the fact that these are activists that are threatening certain economic and political interests. And unfortunately, we are not seeing that these investigations are really answering why these people have been killed.
There's often alarm across Mexican society when there are savage drug cartel killings. How are Mexicans reacting to this string of deaths of environmental activists?
Well, unfortunately, the generalized violence in Mexico has been normalized. People are shocked. It happened one day, next day, many other things are happening. Many other people have been killed by the organized crime and by the violence. You know, having this news about human rights defenders being killed is becoming just the norm.
What do you think these deaths are going to do to the activities of other environmentalists in Mexico?
The dilemma is simple, right? If Mexican environmental activists and human rights defenders are being disappeared or killed with absolute impunity, who will protect nature and who will protect our human rights? Given the lack of state protection, human rights defenders and environmentalists are just being exposed to these levels of violence. But we also need to acknowledge and recognize that in spite of these levels of violence, we continue to see these levels of activism and commitment everywhere in the country, right? Not just environmentalists, but human rights defenders that are representing victims of enforced disappearance, of torture, of many other human rights violations that are standing up and are replacing the responsibility of the state to protect the rights of others.
We heard Homero Gomez Gonzalez in that video earlier with the monarch butterflies, clearly a passionate defender. What legacy does he leave behind?
He leaves an enormous legacy. I do think that the environmental community and the human rights community, we have the obligation to continue with this legacy, not just to protect the monarch butterfly biosphere, but also to protect the environment, to continue demanding from the state action to protect human rights defenders, environmentalists, and journalists who unfortunately are also being killed for their work denouncing these atrocities that are happening against environmentalists. We are in the middle of a climate emergency, and it is important that we don't lose the perspective and that we continue the work that these brave and courageous people are doing to protect the environment and the human rights of others.
Erica Guevara Rosas, the director of Amnesty International Americas, based in Mexico City. Thank you. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Looking to plan your next holiday? More and more Western tourists are heading to Peru, and not necessarily to see Inca ruins. Tourists are looking for spiritual enlightenment through a psychedelic plant used in traditional ceremonies. It's become a booming industry that, as the BBC's Simon Mabin has discovered, is also bringing problems.
In almost total darkness, an Amazonian healer sings to four people sitting on mattresses on the floor of a large circular wooden hut. They've all just drunk a cup of sticky brown ayahuasca. The drink, combined with the healer's sacred song, Oricaro, is said to take people to a higher state of consciousness, to another worldly place where they see deep into their own psyches.
I've basically struggled with anxiety for most of my life, and I tried a variety of different ways of coping with it or treating it, some of which were conventional medicine, some of which were sort of psychotherapy.
Edward Owen, a gentle bearded Brit in his 30s, is one of the people taking part in the ceremony. He says ayahuasca has been a big help in dealing with his anxiety.
You actually viscerally in your body you feel the power of the Icaros, so they may bring on sort of shaking or many things, crying, whatever you need to sort of purge. They feel extremely powerful, and sometimes these songs, they sound beautiful, exquisitely beautiful, and sometimes they sound so painful you can hardly bear another second of them.
Edward's a long-term guest at this ayahuasca centre, hidden away in the jungle, working in exchange for an extended stay. The cheapest short retreat here involves 5 ayahuasca ceremonies over 9 days and costs a hefty $2,300, although that does include meals and accommodation. It clearly has the potential to be a lucrative business, and not everyone's happy about that.
The ones that are making profit here are foreigners, using our brothers and sisters.
Walter Lopez leads a recently established association of healers from the local Shipibo tribe, fighting back against the commercialization and globalization of ayahuasca. Most ayahuasca retreats are foreign-owned and run.
Muchos dicen que la esclavitud ya pasó.
They say slavery ended, but what I say is that slavery modernized. Now we are being exploited. It's our knowledge that they are extracting. We are facing a new colonialism, and what they are taking from us now is our spiritual heritage.
Walter is working with Koshikosh, a political organization that aims to represent the Shipibo people, to try to take control of the ayahuasca industry. Ronald Suarez is the president of Koshikosh. He says foreigners are guilty of spiritual extractivism.
Ellos tienen como sus negocios.
They have their businesses, and they contract our brothers, the healers. But the one who gets the most profit is the foreigner, and they pay a derisory minimum salary to the healer.
Matthew Wotherston runs the retreat center Edward's visiting and says he's working hard to make their impact a positive one.
This came from heart, and it was never about making money. The temple is not a non-profit, but the profit goes into the Amazon through the NGO.
And that's, yeah. Is that still 100% of the profit?
100%.
The NGO works with indigenous people to promote environmental and social justice in the area. And when I ask one of the centre's healers, also Shipibo, about pay, he says he's very happy with what he gets. But many Shipibo live in poverty, in townships with no electricity or running water. Ronald isn't against Shipibo healers working with foreign visitors per se, but says those that do should give back to their community.
Necesitamos mucho apoyo.
We need a lot of support in the process of self-governance, so that we can provide the opportunities for sustainable development that we've already started working on.
Scientific interest in the effects of ayahuasca is growing, and research suggests it could be effective in helping alleviate depression, addiction, and trauma. Walter Lopez is open to collaboration with outsiders, as long as it's done fairly.
Lo que queremos es que la ciencia médica entienda.
We want Western science to understand our plant knowledge, so we can share it. I think we're in a moment for understanding, because there are lots of Westerners that come here with a problem that the Western medical system couldn't solve, and they find relief here. We are afraid that they'll appropriate our spirituality, and Western medical science is afraid of recognizing that they don't know it all.
The BBC's Simon Mabin reporting in the Peruvian Amazon. The impeachment trial is over.
The Senate adjudges that the respondent, Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is not guilty as charged.
The Senate voted to acquit Trump on both articles of impeachment, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. But there was a final surprise today. Mitt Romney, Republican from Utah, voted to convict the president of abuse of power.
The president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust. What he did was not perfect. No, it was a flagrant assault on our electoral rights, our national security, and our fundamental values. Corrupting an election to keep oneself in office is perhaps the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine.
So what was the point of it all? A question I put to Margaret Taylor, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and senior editor with Lawfare.
I think the main sort of thrust of it was that Americans got a lot more information about what President Trump did in this particular instance with Ukraine. I think a lot of that information would not have come out and would not have been known by Americans had this impeachment in the House and then this trial in the Senate not occurred. So I think that's one important thing. By the same token, though, I think, you know, his acquittal will also signal a lot about what is going on in the U.S. political system.
This affair centered on how the U.S. president brokers ties with foreign governments. So if you're a foreign power, what's the takeaway from all of this in terms of how to deal with this administration?
It's a good question. I do think that foreign governments likely are learning or have learned that you can assist a Republican presidential candidate in winning their election. And our political system will largely accept that, it would seem. And I would say, you know, I think Americans, we think of our democracy as so unique and so special, and we should. But there are lots of democracies around the world that do tolerate
some level of sort of foreign meddling or foreign interference in their elections, and they view that as sort of part of the push and pull in their system. So I'll be interested to see if the United States becomes a little bit more like those countries who have a more robust relationship dealing with foreign governmental interference in their democracy.
I mean, that would be kind of unfortunate, wouldn't it?
I think so. And, you know, I think there are just some pretty fundamental questions, some fundamental norms that a lot of Americans thought were unchangeable. And I think what we're seeing is that, in fact, they could very well be changeable. I mean, what we've seen here really is that a sufficient number of senators in the U.S. Senate are basically willing to accept an argument that using the power of the presidency to leverage a foreign government to smear a domestic political opponent to influence the outcome of a presidential election is really a mere policy disagreement and not an impeachable abuse of power. And that's a change. That's a change from how we've thought about that issue before.
Margaret Taylor, fellow at Brookings and senior editor with Lawfare, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
It has been a wild, historic five-month roller coaster ride to get to today. We wanted to look back and recall just how we got here and when all this began. A phone call, two presidents, and a whistleblower. The Washington Post first picked up the story on September 18th. Here's Post reporter Shane Harris at the time describing what they knew.
I think we could kind of deduce that it's quite possible that this involves some kind of negotiation or conversation in which the president may have promised to do something in exchange for something.
Less than a week later, Speaker of the House, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, upped the ante.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security.
Through the month of October, Democrats brought a parade of career U.S. diplomats and officials through the Capitol Hill committee rooms, including some who actually heard that infamous July phone call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Those witnesses described a foreign policy orchestrated by President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, that went outside of regular diplomatic channels to pressure Ukraine into investigating Trump's political rivals.
We did not want to work with Mr. Giuliani. Simply put, we were playing the hand we were dealt.
My impression is that in order to get the White House meeting, President Zelensky would have to deliver these investigations.
I wrote that withholding security assistance in exchange for help with a domestic political campaign in the United States would be crazy. I believed that then, and I believe it now.
That was Ambassador William Taylor, and before him, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and Ambassador Gordon Sondland. Most Republican lawmakers, like Congressman Devin Nunes, were not impressed. Nunes described it as a drama.
The Russia hoax has ended, and you've been cast in the low-rent Ukrainian sequel.
As for the president...
My call was perfect.
We had a perfect phone call with the president of Ukraine. Everybody knows it. It's just a Democrat witch hunt. Here we go.
Still, the Democratic majority in the House pressed on.
Article 1 is adopted.
And passed two articles of impeachment. The articles got held up for a few weeks by Speaker Pelosi, then eventually were marched across the Capitol rotunda for the Senate to make its assessment of the charges. House Democrats chose impeachment managers like Sylvia Garcia and Hakeem Jeffries to make the case to remove President Trump from office.
We will discuss the evidence that shows overwhelmingly that President Trump directed this scheme with corrupt intent.
President Trump tried to cheat, he got caught, and then he worked hard to cover it up.
The president's defense team, including Jay Sekulow and Pat Cipollone, argued that Trump was concerned about widespread corruption in Ukraine.
To lower the bar of impeachment based on these articles of impeachment would impact the functioning of our constitutional republic and the framework of that constitution for generations.
What they are asking you to do is to throw out a successful president on the eve of an election with no basis.
Democratic House managers also pushed hard for new witnesses, namely Trump's former national security advisor John Bolton. At the height of the trial, a manuscript from Bolton's new book was leaked to the New York Times, contradicting the president's defense. Still, the Republican majority chose not to admit any new testimony. And then there was this shocking moment from Trump's lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, that even if the smoking gun were produced, proof that the president asked for a quid pro quo, in this case withholding military aid to Ukraine in exchange for a personal political favor. Well, Dershowitz said if a politician is working in the public interest to get reelected,
that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
Arguments like that left lead House Manager Adam Schiff stunned and imploring senators to remove the president from office.
What are the odds, if left in office, that he will continue trying to cheat? I will tell you, 100%.
Which brings us to now.
I move that the Senate, sitting as a court of impeachment on the articles against Donald John Trump, adjourn sine die.
From the World's Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.